Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief of Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a senior writer at Live Science. The world can be a pretty mysterious place, and we at Live Science love to ask and answer questions about mysteries big and small, about ancient civilizations, our planet and solar system, the plants and animals that live alongside us, our bodies and how they work, and technologies that we use every day.
In today's episode of Life's Little Mysteries, we'll take a closer look at one of the most puzzling animals on our planet, and one that you may share your home with, cats.
So the thing about cats is that most domesticated animals have jobs. I mean, if you look at, you know, dogs and horses, maybe not today, but they were originally domesticated to do work. Or either that or they produce something that we need, you know, like cows or sheep or pigs or chickens. What do cats do? They do nothing.
They can work, though.
Okay. Originally, cats were domesticated for pest control. But most of the time they sleep. And I am a longtime cat owner. I have two wonderful cats and they sleep.
Their biggest activity is sleeping.
Most of the time, right? Cats sleep between 18 to 20 hours a day. So if they don't do anything, and again, love cats, but they don't really do anything useful most of the time. So why do people love them so much? And full disclosure.
We're on Team Cat.
We are both firmly on Team Cat.
So how long ago did cats become domesticated?
Well, cat domestication happened nearly 10,000 years ago. And the earliest evidence that we have is from a grave found in Cyprus with a human and cat buried together. And that dates to about 9,500 years ago.
And genetic analysis of the mitochondrial DNA, that's the DNA that's in the mitochondrial cells and is passed down by females, an analysis of that in ancient cats that were preserved at archaeological sites showed that there were two waves of expansion in early domesticated cats, traveling with people as they migrated.
Right. This was according to a study that was published in the journal Nature in 2016. And it showed that one wave of expansion brought cats from the Middle East to the Mediterranean. Another came out of Egypt to Eurasia and Africa. And the study found mitochondrial DNA from Egyptian cats in cats that were found at an archaeological site of a Viking settlement in northern Germany, dating between AD 700 and AD 1000.
But today, cats seem less domesticated than, say, dogs.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, they seem like they're more aloof, more independent. You know, they're not as, in general, and because, you know, some cats are very needy, but in general, cats tend to be less needy than dogs. They don't need your attention. They can amuse themselves. They can take it, well, except when they need you to feed them. But in general, they don't demand human attention the way that dogs do.
Nevertheless, people are fascinated by cats, even if they don't own them. Just look on the internet.
Right. I mean, the internet was invented for cats. And cats were some of the biggest memes on the internet. And, you know, we have Grumpy Cat and Lil Bub. And there is no shortage of cat videos on the internet.
Adorable cat videos. And cats, in fact, do form attachments to people.
No, this is true. Cats are not as aloof as they are made out to be. There was a study that was published in 2017 that showed that cats seek out human attention. And we're going to be talking about that one a little bit later in the show. And they prefer it over anything else, even food. So,
in other words, they like us.
They really, really like us. But there's something else that cats like a lot. And that's the subject of today's first mystery. People talk about thinking outside the box, but cats definitely prefer to think inside the box. Any box, but especially cardboard boxes. And actually suitcases, too. In October of last year, there was a couple that was flying from the UK to New York, and they were pulled aside by security because they found a stowaway cat in their suitcase.
And I'm not surprised that a cat would be comfy inside there.
No. I know every time I have to go on a trip and I open up my suitcase on the bed to pack, I leave the room for 2 minutes, I come back, there's at least one cat in it. Always. So, and then, of course, you know, there's the famous, you know, the internet famous cat Maru.
Oh, yeah. That's a record-breaking cat. The video of that cat was viewed 35 million times.
And what was the cat doing? The cat was basically just jumping into boxes or sitting in boxes.
They were much squishing
too small
itself.
Yes, Maru was not a slender cat. And some of the boxes were very, very small. So for today's first mystery, we ask, why do cats love boxes?
So we know they're cryptic animals. They like to hide.
Right. And so yes, cats are very good at hiding. They'll hide under your bed. They'll hide under your furniture. They'll hide in your closets. And boxes actually make them feel safe because it's an enclosed space. So you may have noticed that, you know, some cats like to sit in sinks because that's also somewhat of an enclosed space and makes them feel safe. But they really, really like boxes.
And does that come from any wild behavior before they were domesticated?
Yes. In the wild, cats conceal themselves to hide from predators and to ambush prey. And in general, I love the cats being described as being bad at conflict resolution.
They totally
This is why they hide, because their typical response is to hide because they're bad at conflict resolution. So according to the book, The Domestic Cat, The Biology of Its Behavior, cats, and this is, I'm quoting the author, cats do not appear to develop conflict resolution strategies to the extent that more gregarious species do. So they do, in other words, they deal with conflict, and I'm quoting again here, by avoiding others or decreasing their activity. So some other types of animals might deal with conflict by becoming more aggressive, but cats, their instinct is to run away and hide.
So when they're afraid or stressed, they hide in boxes in whatever confined space they can find.
Anywhere they can find, right. So in fact, a study from 2014 in the journal Applied Animal Behavior Science that was conducted with shelter cats, a group of cats were given hiding boxes, and a group of cats were not given boxes. And the researchers wanted to see if having boxes could reduce stress. And so this was a study that was done with 19 cats that were new to a shelter. They were divided into two groups. And over 14 days, one group had hiding boxes and one didn't. And the scientists observed the cats' stress levels.
So what happened after a few days?
Well, by day three or four, the cats that had the hiding boxes showed fewer signs of stress. And you would think, how do they look for signs of stress?
Oh, I love this. There's actually a cat stress index. And I think there are 10 features or variables they look at. They look at everything from whether their whiskers are straight out or angled back, their ears, their tails. If their tails are extended, that means they're stressed versus a relaxed tail.
So there are all these little markers that they could look at to see if the cats are stressed. And so by day three or four, they found that the cats that had hiding boxes, they showed fewer of these signs of stress, they were less shy, and they were more interested in interacting with people.
Were these certain types of boxes, just cardboard boxes?
Well, cardboard boxes are especially attractive to cats, as I think everybody knows, because opaque boxes make cats feel like they're at least partly hidden, even if the boxes are open at the top. So if they crouch down and they can't be seen, then, you know, or they can't see out, they figure that nobody can see in. So that makes them feel a little bit safer. And but boxes also provide them with a place to sleep. And as we mentioned before, cats sleep up to 18 to 20 hours a day.
It's amazing that they actually spend that amount of time sleeping. So why do they seem to like all of our boxes, our Amazon boxes, any cardboard box that comes into the house, cats jump into?
Right. Well, cardboard boxes in particular are especially attractive to cats because cardboard is a really good insulator and it helps them keep warm. So when cats are, and this is actually interesting, I didn't know this, when cats are just lying around and they're not expending any energy, then their thermoneutral zone is 86 to 100 degrees Fahrenheit, which
like
is
like their 30, resting temperature.
That is the ideal temperature for them to not expend energy, right?
Okay.
So that's 86 to 100 degrees Fahrenheit or 30 to 38 degrees Celsius, according to a study that was published in 2016 in the Scientific World Journal. So, and typically houses where cats live are, you know, are kept a little bit cooler than that. They're usually somewhere in the 70 degrees Fahrenheit range, and so sitting in a box actually helps to keep them warm.
And cats seem to like to scratch these boxes also.
Right. Well, cats like to scratch many things, and cardboard is a really good satisfying surface.
Satisfying for them, but the noise is not satisfying.
Not satisfying for people. But digging their claws into cardboard, well, you know, if the choice is between having them scratching at a cardboard box or having them scratch at your furniture, you'd probably
take the box.
Probably pick the box. Yeah. And it's not just domestic cats. So tigers, leopards, cougars, lynxes, bobcats, they all like boxes too.
Even for teen cats, our feline friends can often seem aloof and ultra-independent, more boss than companion. But cats do also snuggle up with their human owners, using their meows and body language to ask for scritches behind the ears and tummy rubs. So do cats get attached to their owners like dogs do? Here to talk to us about that is Kristen Vitale, a scientist at the Human-Animal Interaction Lab at Oregon State University. Hi, Kristen. Thanks so much for joining us. So why did you decide to look at how cats bond with people?
Well, you know, there's a lot of cats in the world. There's actually more cats than dogs in a lot of countries. And so cats have actually received relatively little scientific attention. And with so many cats living in human homes, it kind of seemed like an area of study that needed to be done. And so we just decided to look at some of those relationships between cats and their owners.
Did anything tip you off that cats might be bonding with their owners, or did you just decide to look at cats as scientists have looked at dogs?
Well, in our prior research, we had actually found that cats are displaying similar levels of sociability towards humans as dogs. And so this idea that cats aren't, you know, enjoying social interaction or they're not very social wasn't something we were finding. So that kind of led us to this area where we were thinking, well, if cats are social with people, well, maybe they also form a bond. So that's kind of where we started with that.
How did you get at the answer to that question?
Yeah, we actually had 100 kittens come into the lab and around 38 adult cats. And yeah, all of them were solicited from surrounding community and also the Oregon State community as well.
How did you figure out the bonding capacity of these cats and kittens?
We actually used the same kind of tests that they would use to look at a dog's bond toward their owners. And actually, it's the same kind of test that people use to look at human infants' bond toward their parents. And basically, the idea is the individuals put into a strange situation in which they're maybe not sure how to act, and they might be a little freaked out. And so when an animal or a human is put into that state, it actually will heighten any attachment behaviors that exist, and we're then able to measure them in that scenario. So we basically just brought these cats into our lab for 2 minutes. They could just hang out in the lab with their owner, and this was just to get a baseline idea of how they behave. And then the owner left the room for 2 minutes. And this alone phase was actually our potential stressor for the cat. If they have attachment behavior, we should have seen that they're crying for their owner, they're searching for them. And then when their owner comes back to the room after that brief separation, we should see some of these distinct attachment behaviors that they're displaying toward them.
And let's take a step back. What do you mean by attachment? And what are some of those attachment behaviors that you were looking for?
So attachment is basically an enduring social bond, but it's also a very important set of behaviors that are related to an individual's survival and protection, and also being able to go out and investigate the world and learn more. Attachment really works to make the animal feel more secure and, you know, be able to not only receive protection from their attachment figure, but go out, learn new things, explore out from where they were born. And so attachment behaviors are things like if they're separated from their attachment figure, they'll start crying, and that cry is to elicit the caretaker to come back. If they're separated from the caretaker, we see that they are seeking to be near them. They want to be near, and they want to be in contact and receiving attention. And so these behaviors together are working so that that animal can not only receive protection from their owner or their parents, but again, go out and explore new things.
And what did you find?
We found that cats will behave in the same distinct ways that, again, dogs behave toward their owners in the scenario, and human babies behave toward their parents. So what we saw was basically two major class of responses. The first was a secure response. And this was actually the majority of cats. This was around 65% of both cats and kittens that we tested were secure. And so what this means is that when the owner was gone, they showed some distress, they were crying, they were looking for the owner, they were sitting by the door. But when the owner came back, they greeted them, you know, there's a happy, comforting greeting. And then the cat goes back to whatever they were doing before that owner left. So this shows that the cat received comfort from the owner and, again, is able to return to normal behavior. And this is an idea of a secure base effect where the owner is basically providing reassurance to the cat so they're not freaked out and they realize, oh, okay, I don't need to be upset in this situation. Everything's okay.
So other cats didn't behave in that way, I'm guessing. Is that something they've learned, or is it genetic, or is it a mix of both of those?
Around 35% had an insecure response, so they persist in being upset or distressed, even though the owner has come back. And instead, they actively just cling to their owner and never leave their side, which is an ambivalent response. or they sit away from the owner and avoid them, which is an avoidant response.
Let's say someone has an insecurely attached cat or kitten. Could you help those cats to become more securely attached to you?
Yeah, we're not really sure. We actually put half of the kittens that participated through a kitten training and socialization class because we wanted to see if maybe, like you're saying, some of these attachment behaviors are things that are reinforced by the owner over time. And we actually found that kittens didn't show any significant difference before or after the class, and no difference to the control kittens either. And so that's really showing us that this is a relatively stable behavioral trait and might be more characteristic of, the personality of the cat and their owner combined. And that might have some to do with genetics and life experience kind of mixing together. But we don't really know the exact causes of this time.
What would you say if a cat owner wanted to at least try a socialization training class? How does it work?
These kittens went through basically what a puppy would go through for a 6-week class. And so they came in, they were clicker trained, they learned to sit, come when called, go to mat and stay, they learned tricks. So if people are interested in training their cats, they definitely should try that. And even though we didn't find it had a huge impact on changing a cat's attachment style, it can still be a bond building activity that can engage your cat's mind and, strengthen the interactions that you have with them.
So what's next in your lab? Any more questions you plan to answer in the cat world?
Oh, yeah. There's so many questions about cats. Right now, we're actually running a similar test, but looking at pairs of cats. So if cats within a household are attached to one another. And we're also looking at shelter cats and looking at what factors maybe go into the formation of those attachments initially.
I was just speaking to Kristen Vitale, a cognitive scientist at Oregon State University. For more about her research, visit the Human Animal Interaction Lab at Oregon State University at thehumananimalbond.com. Thanks so much for joining us, Kristen.
Gina, I know we'd be perfectly happy to keep talking about cats, but first, we want to bring you a special offer for a subscription to the magazine All About Space. From dark matter to explosive supernovas, All About Space features the latest developments in space science, from here in our solar system to the farthest perimeter of the universe.
Maybe you want to know more about the amazing technology behind the latest rocket launches and missions exploring the cosmos. Or maybe you're a stargazer searching for a complete guide to the night sky. All About Space has you covered.
In the latest issue, All About Space explores mysterious Fermi bubbles. What are they? What are Fermi bubbles? These are two giant orbs of gas and charged particles that were burped out by our galaxy's supermassive black hole, and they're visible in X-ray and gamma-ray light. So if you imagine the center, of the Milky Way, they extend above and below, and their total length is about 50,000 light years, and it's kind of an hourglass shape sort of pinched in the middle.
It's a gorgeous image, and they sound just humongous. And they were detected in 2010 by the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope because they emit these high-energy gamma rays, which is it's the equivalent of trillions of supernova explosions.
Right, so that's a lot of energy. And bubbles like this are observed in other galaxies, but it was actually surprising for scientists to find them in the Milky Way because our black hole is so much smaller than in galaxies that have these similar bubbles.
So scientists have three ideas about how these Fermi bubbles form.
Right. So one idea is that there was a rapid energetic event at the center of the Milky Way, and this took place less than 10 million years ago. Then another idea is that the Fermi bubbles were created as stars formed near the galactic center, and this took place over a few hundred million to a billion years ago. And then the third idea is that...
Which is my favorite one.
Yeah, the third one is very dramatic. It's the third idea is that they are the leftovers of a star that was cannibalized by the black hole. And so basically the black hole at the center of the Milky Way ripped the star apart. This released huge amounts of energy, and that's what formed the Fermi bubbles. So, but for now, how the bubbles formed and what feeds them is still unknown.
Even though these giant Fermi bubbles will remain mysterious, they do shed some light on what's hiding at the center of our Milky Way.
And what is hiding at the center of the Milky Way?
Well, one object we know is lurking there is a supermassive black hole called Sagittarius A. And a Live Science reporter described a possible solution to explain why this invisible beast at the center of our Milky Way has been so quiet.
And that's unusual for it to be quiet.
Unusual. You know, many galaxies, we think all galaxies have one of these black holes at the center. And those black holes are usually pretty active. So as material flows around them, once that material passes the event horizon, the black holes basically consume it. And all of that, like, devouring of matter and gas and dust creates lots of friction and emits X-rays and light.
But that's the black hole at the center of the Milky Way is actually kind of quiet.
Eerily quiet. And we know that there are these invisible magnetic field lines that are wrapped around this black hole. And what's new is that images reveal that those lines form a structure that is huge. It extends light years across space. And scientists think that invisible structure might be allowing our black hole to basically slumber.
So it's acting like some kind of a net around it or something?
Yeah, it's an enclosure. It's a structure that might be so powerful that basically it blocks all that material from falling into the black hole and then this process of the black hole eating it, consuming it, and spitting out light.
So these magnetic structures, that's what's keeping our black hole from being as active as some other black holes.
Exactly.
You can venture further into the mysteries of the universe by subscribing to All About Space today. Just visit myfavoritemagazines.com and search for All About Space. We have a special discount code just for our Life's Little Mysteries listeners. You can get an additional 20% off by using the code SPACEPOD at checkout. Subscriptions start at just $5. That's myfavoritemagazines.com. Use the code SPACEPOD for an extra 20% off.
And visit livescience.com to read more about this invisible magnetic field smothering our nearest supermassive black hole. Anyone who's lived with a cat for any amount of time has seen them do some pretty hilarious, wild behaviors in the confines of a very domestic indoor space.
Oh my God. One of my favorite ones is when we used to live in an apartment that had a view of a tree, like right outside the window, and at dusk, all these birds would come and roost in the tree. And our cats would just, they would sit outside the window and they would make this weird little noise, like this weird little hunting noise. And that was the only time I ever heard them do it. And it was just like, I'm like, who are you talking to? What are you trying to do here?
They really are wild at heart. I mean, they run around wild as if they're chasing or hiding from predators. And one of these quirky behaviors is the butt wiggle.
The butt wiggle, that's right. There's actually an internet meme for that too, as there is for almost everything related to cats. But yes, it's a very distinctive wiggle that they have.
So why do cats wiggle their butts before they pounce on everything from a toy to random plastic bags?
Well, why do cats pounce in the first place?
It turns out that cats are quick, but their prey are also quick. So if they're running around chasing a squirrel or a rabbit, they're probably not going to catch their prey.
Right.
So they're pretty smart. Instead, cats wait and stalk until the exact right moment to launch an attack.
Okay, so how does butt wiggling help them launch that attack?
Surprisingly, there are no official studies that have looked into this behavior.
That's a missed opportunity.
It totally is. But one researcher who studies animal locomotion has some ideas about why they do it. John Hutchinson, he's a professor of evolutionary biomechanics at the Royal Veterinary College in London. He says it may help them press the hind limbs into the ground. So while they're getting ready to pounce, they press and they wiggle, and that gives the cat traction to push them forward into their pounce, into their prey.
Oh, so that's kind of like a runner in a race where they have these blocks that they put under their feet for them to push off from?
Exactly. It's exactly like that. And Hutchinson said it might also have a sensory role. So it gets the cat's vision and muscles into the game before they pounce. So they're rubbing their feet against the floor. They're wiggling. They're getting all their senses ready to go.
So shaking their butts actually helps to sort of prime their focus.
Exactly.
Okay.
And there's other ideas. So another idea is that butt wiggling may give the cat sort of an aerobic warm-up. It helps them stretch their pouncing muscles.
Okay, right, because, you know, pouncing is an energetic thing to do, and you need to warm up before it, but you have to do it in a small, controlled way because you don't want to spook the prey.
And they're warming up probably their hind legs, which are big muscles, to help them bound forward.
But are they enjoying it? I mean, you know, come on, like shaking your butt, isn't that something that it's fun for people?
Hutchinson had something to say about that. He said that it really might just be plain fun for them. You know, cats do plenty of things that seem silly, and maybe they are just excited by the thrill of this hunt, and they're just shaking their butts.
So, but how could scientists possibly tell like what they're using the butt wiggling for and you know, what purpose it serves.
An ideal experiment would have cats pounce with and without this butt wiggling. So scientists could actually determine what effect the wiggling, or the lack thereof, has on their pouncing performance. Are they, you know, hitting their target? Are they way off? Are they not fast enough?
See, now I'm just imagining scientists designing some kind of a special sling to put cats in to keep them from wiggling their butts before they pounce, because otherwise, you know, it's like, how do you control that behavior? You have to do something to restrain them.
And is that cat going to keep the mechanism, the device on? Probably not.
It's a fascinating question.
And domestic cats aren't alone in this behavior. As we found with other behaviors, wild cats, even fierce creatures like lions, tigers, jaguars, they shake their derrieres before striking.
Well, you know, the thing is that cats, they, you know, sometimes when they pounce on your feet, you see that little butt wiggle. But hopefully wild cats are not pouncing at your feet.
Exactly.
Cats have wiggled their way into our lives for thousands of years. In ancient Egypt, cats were so important that they were often mummified and entombed with their owners. And a recent discovery of a cat mummy dating to 2,500 years ago had a surprise hiding inside. Here to talk to us about that is Live Science Associate Editor Laura Gegel. Thanks for joining us, Laura.
Thanks, Mindy. It's good to be here.
So how were scientists able to look inside and see what the mummy looked like inside?
Yeah, so thank goodness for modern technology, because the last thing we want to do is open up this delicate, precious cat mummy. We don't want to disturb it. So scientists use CT scans, which is computed tomography scans, and it basically takes thousands upon thousands of x-rays so that the scientists using computer software can make a 3D digital image and then rotate it and look at it from every single angle on their computer screens. It's super useful and doesn't harm the object at all.
And once they did that, what did they find inside?
Right. So you would think they would find a cat mummy, right?
Well,
little feline. That's not what they found.
What did they find?
They found, instead of a skull, they found a ball of cloth. There were no ribs. There were no vertebrae. And they found five cat hind limbs from three different cats.
What?
So very much a surprise for the scientists. And it's actually not that uncommon to find kind of a mishmash of animal remains in these kinds of mummies.
So what might explain that? Why might more than one animal be buried as in a single mummy?
Right. So kind of just to backtrack a little bit, animal mummies in ancient Egypt were an industry and very profitable for the people who were farming these poor animals. They might make these animals appear bigger so that they could charge more money for them, or they might actually not put an animal in there at all and swindle the purchaser who thinks they're getting an animal mummy. In this case, you know, it's not clear if they were doing a hoax of some kind of sort, you know, saying, here's your cat, and they're only putting five hind limbs in. Or actually, maybe it kind of served a purpose and it was symbolic, and we'll just never know. There really aren't any clues left to tell us.
So, but cat mummies in general were pretty common at this time. So what are some other noteworthy examples that you could tell us about?
Yeah. Oh, man, the Egyptians loved cats. They actually had a goddess called Bastet, which took the form of a cat. And Bastet, she was kind of more for women, I suppose. She was the goddess of domesticity and childbirth, and she was supposed to protect against evil spirits and diseases. So it's really no surprise that we find so many cat mummies buried in Egypt. And actually, there are even cat mummies that themselves have offerings, meaning that people were preparing the cats for the afterlife. It wasn't just the cats accompanying the people to the afterlife. So I believe it was just in December, they found some lion cub mummies in Egypt. And they'd only ever found one before, so this was a very big deal. You know, before they found tens of cat mummies in a burial near Saqqara. And often these cat mummies are accompanied by a statue of Bastet, the goddess taking the shape of a cat, or, you know, at least for Egyptian lore.
So as special as people think that their cats are today, in ancient Egypt, cats had an even more elevated position in the house.
Oh, completely. And it most likely started with domesticating cats. Egypt is one of the first places to have done that. So it most likely started with farmers using cats to control the rats and mice that were eating their grain. And then the cats became pets, and they became quite pampered if you look at hieroglyphic scenes from that era. And then, of course, this Bastet goddess I was talking about actually had a cult following. And people would go to her temple and leave all kinds of offerings. And actually, what's really fascinating, if your cat died, I read that you might shave off your eyebrows as a symbol of mourning because you were so sad that, you know, Fluffy had passed.
Wow. Well, that's, yeah, I think that's a lot farther than most people would go today for their cats. Far as cat cults go, I don't know. There may be a new cat cult springing up around the Cats movie, but other than that,
possible.
I'm not sure. Yeah.
We'll wait and see where that goes.
Laura Gegel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great talking with you.
Check out the article, Inside Ancient Egyptian Cat Mummy, Archaeologists Find the Remains of Three Cats, on Live Science. The link is in the show notes. So maybe modern cats don't exactly get the royal treatment that they did in ancient Egypt. But today, we do have a special treat that is given only to cats, an herb called catnip.
Ah, the bliss and euphoria that seems to overcome your cat after a little catnip.
It's really dramatic. They roll on their backs, they run around, they drool, they lick the catnip, and they flop over and just kind of lie there purring. It's euphoric behavior that superficially looks like what's happening when a person is under the influence of recreational drugs.
But what is actually going on? Is a similar process going on inside the cat's brain?
Well, for our last mystery, we're going to talk about catnip. Does it really make cats high?
First off, what exactly is catnip? Because it's not cannabis.
No, not at all. Its scientific name is Nepeticataria, and it belongs to the mint family, which includes aromatic herbs such as rosemary, sage, oregano, and basil. And the compound that gives catnip its high is called nepetalactone. And the compound is produced in specialized glands in catnip's leaves and flowers. Other compounds in catnip affect cat's neurotransmitters and can inhibit activity in the central nervous system, but the effects of nepetalactone are the strongest.
So we know that it has the nepetalactone in there, but what attracts the cats to the catnip?
It's the scent. So nepetalactone binds to special receptors in cats' noses, and that's what produces the behavior resembling euphoria.
So in humans, drinking alcohol or smoking marijuana stimulates brain cells that release a mood-altering dopamine.
Right.
Is that what's happening in cats?
Not necessarily. While cats are on catnip, they seem to be enjoying themselves, but scientists can't say for sure what's happening in their brains. However, some studies have shown that when cats are given compounds like naloxone, which block opioid receptors in the central nervous system, catnip's effects are minimized or even eliminated. And that suggests that opioid receptors might be involved. And when I was writing this, I spoke to Dr. Bruce Kornreich, who's an associate director for education and outreach with the Feline Health Center at Cornell University College of Veterinary Medicine in Ithaca, New York. And he told me that a person who takes an opioid and has a euphoric effect from it, that can be blocked by naloxone. And if a cat has behaviors that can be blocked by naloxone, then might one of those behaviors, in the cat's perception at least, be euphoria? It's possible, he said, but we don't know for sure.
And do all cats respond strongly to catnip with this rolling around, this drooling, this euphoric behavior?
Well, once it was thought that about two-thirds of adult cats responded visibly to catnip, and that seems like a lot. But a study that was published in 2017 in the journal Behavioral Processes suggests that some cats may exhibit a less active response. So they're still responding to catnip, but it's not as visible as some of the behaviors. So they vocalize less or they assume a sphinx-like pose. And that actually suggests that most cats, or maybe even all cats, are affected by catnip to some degree.
We've talked about how wild cats share domestic cats' fondness for boxes, and how they also wiggle their butts before pouncing. Do wild cats share a liking for catnip too?
Some actually do. Jim Simon, a professor of plant biology and co-director of the Center for Sensory Sciences and Innovation at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey, told me that hunters have actually used catnip to trap cougars and mountain lions. And what they do is they hang the dried plants to lure the big cats. And studies have also shown that lions, leopards, and jaguars respond to the compounds found in catnip.
And I'd love to see that, these big wild cats rolling around.
Yeah. But tigers, oddly enough, tigers are the exception. They can take it or leave it, and catnip does not seem to affect them at all.
Aw, too bad.
Too bad for the tigers. Thanks for joining us today for Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. All of today's feline mysteries, why do cats like boxes? Why Do Cats Wiggle Their Butts Before They Pounce? And Does Catnip Really Make Cats High? Are available as Life's Little Mysteries articles on our website, livescience.com. You can also find out more about these mysteries in this podcast's notes.
Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter for even more Life's Little Mysteries and for the latest science news. You can also join the conversation in our Live Science forums, where you can pose Life's Little Mysteries questions of your own or even suggest topics for upcoming podcast episodes. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss out on new episodes. What will we talk about next? It's a mystery.
Literally, it'll be another Life's Little Mystery.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audioboom as part of their Audioboom Originals Network.